Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Once a week, we take on a topic, a serious topic, generally not given a lot of attention in the mainstream or even the alternative media. And frequently when they do give us their insights with their experts from various think tanks, it's almost always skewed. It's extremely biased. And that's why we like to bring in people who are not here to promote any political or ideological point, but rather simply give us their impressions, their insights, their truths. Today, the rising epidemic of poverty in America and how corporations and banks increase it for profit and power. My two guests today are Dr. Dean Baker. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He is frequently cited because of his insights and because of his extremely accurate track record. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited in the UK, and his blog Beat the Press features commentary on economic reporting. In the past, Dr. Baker was a senior economist for the Economic Policy Institute and a professor at Bucknell University. He was also served as a consultant for the World Bank, the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, and the OECD's Trade Union Advisory Council. He's written several books, including False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Energy. His latest book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, is available at the Center for Economic and Policy Research website at cepr.net. My second guest today is Sasha Abramsky. Sasha is a journalist and educated at Oxford and Columbia Universities. He is now a senior fellow specializing in inequality, poverty, and incarceration in the criminal justice system at the nonpartisan think tank Demos in New York City. He regularly writes for The Guardian and has written for The Nation, Atlantic Monthly, American Prospect, and Mother Jones. He's the author of several books, including Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger and How to Fix It, and more recently, Inside Obama's Brain. And his website is SashaAbramsky.com, SashaAbramsky. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thanks for being here.
I have been working on a documentary on Poverty, Inc. for about 5 years. More than 1,000 hours filmed, over 300 people from various fields. And then, of course, a two-year journey around the United States, going from town to town and talking to the new poor. I'm not talking about the Louisiana dirt poor farmer or the Alabama farmer or where I come from in Appalachia. I'm talking about people who, more often than not, are college educated, who had a quality of life, a standard of living that they were able to maintain, and then one day they began to lose it. And then based upon the choices they made, today many of them have lost everything, and others, though they may still have something, have no real support coming to their aid. As one woman told me recently, she said, it's not will I be homeless, it's when. And what made her case particularly interesting to film was that she had been introduced to me by a woman who was meeting other women who are senior citizens. All of them had college backgrounds, all came from a financially conservative background, meaning they tended to be very conscious about what they spent and they saved. But in all cases, the five women that I had met sitting around this table, they all shared some common factors. One, their companies were taken over by equity partnerships or some other medium and downsized. Two, in two cases, the women were actually expected to train people coming in from India, in one case in South Korea, in another case, for their jobs, which would take about 3 months of this training. And then once they were trained, they were to be let go. Separately, they all had waited too late to try to sell their property. And in two cases, they didn't have a mortgage, but then they were paying for their children's education, and historically, under the assumption that when you graduate from college, you'll get a job, and generally you'll get a job in the field where you're educated, and then you'll be able to take over the loan. In three of the women's cases, they were paying for their children's education. Two of the children had graduated, and in over a year and a half had found no work at all and were living at home. The trouble is, now that they did not have any income, and they were living off their savings, and in one case mortgaging their home, the value of their property went below their mortgage payments. And as a result, they were underwater in their mortgages. In two of the five people, they were going to food banks where they used to volunteer to actually get food for themselves and their family, something they felt was very humiliating. And all of them said the same thing. When I asked, what is the message you would like me to share with the American public? They said, we don't have advocates. Nowhere are you seeing people discussing our plight. And that's unfortunate because we are both Democrat and Republican. We're both conservative and liberal. But we have all been hit hard. That's where we begin our journey. I'm going to begin with you, Dean Baker, on this issue. And also Sasha, who's unfortunately on a cell phone, stuck in some traffic, will be coming in and out of this. What you feel are the primary social and economic forces right now that can tilt almost 76 million Americans living near poverty level into a better state than what they are? What are the causes? What's behind it? How did they evolve? Could you share with us? Take your time. There's no rushing.
Well, I see, sir, two separate stories. One was the longer-term story. We'd been seeing an upward redistribution of income for the last three decades, and that's a variety of forces, and I'll get into that in a second. But that really dates back to the 80s, the 90s, you know, and through the last decade. But then we had the cataclysm and the collapse of the housing bubble. We had the housing bubble was driving the economy through the last business cycle. That was basically from 2001 through 2007, and we saw house prices hit record highs. And that was clearly unsustainable and was going to collapse. And, of course, it did collapse. And that gave us the current downturn. And that made everything qualitatively worse. So all the things that we'd been seeing going on, hollowing out of the economy, we're losing a lot of good-paying manufacturing jobs, deunionization, there are a lot of things you could point to that were making things harder for the middle class and obviously for the poor as well through the 80s, 90s, and the last decade. But the bottom really fell out when the housing bubble collapsed in 2007, 2008, and we're not really recovered from that to any great extent. I mean, things are better now than they were in 2009, 2010, but we're very, very far to go just to get back to where we were in 2007, which was by no means a great situation. So people were struggling in 2007. Most workers weren't seeing wage growth. Insofar as people felt prosperous, for the most part, it was because their house price was going up. And, you know, obviously that's not going to continue. That didn't continue, and we've reversed that. And basically the story you have now, and this is, you know, people should be very upset about that because you're saying that these women said they have no advocates, and that's very, very much true because in Washington there's a sense, oh, yes, that's really bad. We'll just have to tough it out. I don't know how many times I've heard people say that. And invariably the people who are saying that are people who are working at six-figure jobs, never been unemployed, probably don't have any close friends and family who are unemployed, and they're talking about toughing it out. Well, they're not toughing it out. I'm sure they're not happy to hear these stories, but, you know, the point is it's not them. It's not people they associate with or particularly think about. So we don't see policy oriented towards changing that, or at least not changing the situation anytime soon. And, you know, again, regardless of whether we see President Obama reelected or Governor Romney gets in the White House, neither of them can really stand up there with a straight face. So maybe they will, I don't know. But, you know, neither of them has a plan where they could say we realistically think that these people that you're talking about are going to get back to work and have decent paying jobs anywhere in the near future.
Okay, I appreciate that as an opening statement. Let me share a little background figures, and then I'll ask you to respond to another question. Last May, The UN's UNICEF agency released a report that ranks second highest in child poverty among 35 developing nations after Romania is the U.S. And the report determined that just over 23% of American children live in poverty now. And the Pew Research Center also found that 85% of middle-class Americans say that it's harder to maintain a middle-class standard of living today compared with just 10 years ago. In addition, median household income for the self-employed has fallen 9.4% in just the last 2 years, and the median household income for private sector employees has fallen 4.5%. Now, according to the Federal Reserve, the median net worth of all families in the United States declined from $126,400 to $77,300, and that's all families, but that takes into account the wealthiest as well. And as Dan Ariely from Duke University and Mike Norton from Harvard University have shown empirically, 40% of the U.S. population, the 40% less well-off, own only 0.3%, that is 0.3% of America's personal wealth. Now, who owns the other 99.7%? The top 20% have 84% of the country's wealth, and those Americans in the third and fourth groups, essentially America's middle class, have only 15.7% of the nation's wealth. Such an unequal distribution of income is unprecedented in the economically developed world. So then I would ask you to respond to the following. I would like for you to speak about the relationship between education and poverty. There are two related questions. First, the figures are clear that the percentages of people in poverty correlate to the levels of education. For example, in 2010, 30% of those in poverty had less than a high school education, and the figures lessened for those with high school or associate or than a college degree, around 5%. Could this change for the worse, irrespective of educational levels, because more and more college graduates are swamped into student debt, can't find a living wage, and there's no viable policy now to shift this direction? Furthermore, the areas of job increase we find during the past year are primarily low-paying jobs, not requiring a college degree. Could you address this, please?
Yeah, a couple things. First off, you know, the declines in wealth are overwhelmingly because most people have most of their wealth in their homes. When house prices plummeted, that was the wealth of most people. And housing tends to be heavily leveraged asset. People buy a home with 10% down, 20% down. Of course, at the peak of the bubble, zero down. So when your housing, when your house price fell, as it did in many cases, 30, 40, 50%, people's equity very often just disappeared. So, you know, you had a lot of people pushing home ownership as the end-all and be-all, pretending that was very safe. I think a lot of these people really misled people into buying a home in a lot of cases where they shouldn't. In terms of viable policy, I think it is important to understand there are viable policies. They might not be politically viable, but there are viable policies. I mean, if you spend money, you will create jobs. There's no doubt about that. President Obama's stimulus basically worked exactly as predicted. It was a stimulus designed to create 2 to 3 million jobs, and that's what it did. Problem was, we needed 10 to 12 million. Unfortunately, President Obama, for whatever reason, has been a very bad salesperson for that stimulus, maybe because he doesn't want to own up to the fact that he didn't ask for enough money. But the reality was, and you can go back, I mean, it's on the website, this is all written January 2009, so now if it's 2020 hindsight, this was looking forward. They predicted their stimulus would create 2 to 3 million jobs, and, you know, great, that was useful. But now when you need 10 to 12, or at least it wasn't sufficient. In terms of the quality of jobs, again, education, you know, the more education people can get, the better. But exactly as you said, you have a lot of people with AB degrees, you know, technical degrees of different sort, college degrees now, who are in poverty. It's certainly no guarantee, but there's no doubt about it. You're better off with a college degree than without. But one point I'd make, and I think there's been a lot of confusion on this, the reason we have bad jobs, the economy's been creating bad jobs, is because there aren't enough good jobs. It's really that simple. I think a lot of people are really confused. There are always bad jobs out there. I want to hire doctors for $10 an hour. Well, they won't work for me for $10 an hour because they have the option to get $250,000 a year. The reason people are taking bad jobs is because they don't have good jobs. So it's not that the economy's creating bad jobs. They're always creating bad jobs. It's just people won't take them. So the point here isn't that somehow the economy starts to create bad jobs, point is it's not creating good jobs. And again, we could do that. We could fix that. We spend money. That's why you do it, you know, and you get kind of this, you know, probably should think of a better term, but I would just call it idiocy, that, you know, people say stuff like the government doesn't create jobs, and you're sort of left scratching your head. What do you mean? If the government is hiring teachers, that's not creating jobs. If it's hiring firefighters, if it's hiring people to repair the infrastructure, that's not, I don't quite understand. What are those people doing? Those sure look like jobs. So in Washington, somehow that's a serious position, and I literally don't know what these people think they mean when they say that, because, as I say, it's just like saying the earth is flat. I don't know what they think. But, you know, I just emphasize this because there are viable solutions, you know, and we've known these for 70 years. We got out of the Great Depression with World War II. There was no magic to it being a war. We spent a ton of money. That's what did it. That's what got the economy back to full employment. You spend a ton of money, you will put people to work, and ideally we would do in productive things, making us a wealthier nation, building up our infrastructure, dealing with our health issues, all the problems that we see across the country. Unemployment's a source of wealth. The point is we're providing everyone, or the people we're providing, with food, clothing, shelter, and still having more than 20 million people unemployed, underemployed, out of the workforce altogether. Those are people that could be producing goods and services that are needed. So it's the solutions are there. We know how to do it. The problem is that the people in positions of power really don't care.
All right. I'm going to come back in a few moments with part two of that, because I'm very concerned that over the last 30 years, the equity partnerships or the corporate raiders were downsizing America, and no one seemed to be paying that much attention or caring, because for a long time, people were able to get another job, not necessarily in their own industry. But today that's not the case, and when you start looking at the number of factories closed and downsized and the number of people who can't get a job where they were formerly trained or maintain a standard of living they had built up over years, I have to ask, how can either of the people participating in this current presidential race address that, since both of them have supported the outsourcing of jobs overseas? But that'll be the issue I come back to you with. Now we have Sasha on the phone. Again, Sasha's in a car on a cell phone, so we apologize if we're having technical difficulty. Sasha, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and I really do apologize. I got stuck in a 100-mile traffic jam. So.
Understandable, no problem. Sasha, there are now over 66 million people living at or below 125% of the federal poverty level. That would be about $28,800 annual income for a family of four. Now, these are figures from the Census Bureau. How are we to understand the metrics the U.S. government uses for determining poverty statistics? And would you say this is accurate, or is the poverty level worse if based upon other statistical methods that they're aware of and not using?
Well, the poverty line, we sort of think of it as this magic number. We hear the words poverty line, and we assume that people below it are poor and people above it are rich. It's actually much more nuanced than that. The poverty line is a guess. It's a guess as to what amount of money you need to pay your rent, to put gas in your car, to keep your electricity going, to pay your utility bills. It's guesswork. So when we say that there's X number of million, whether it's 40 million, 50 million, 60 million, at or around the poverty line, what we mean is that that percentage of the population is hitting a number that the government estimates if you reach it, you can just about survive. It doesn't mean you're going to have things easy. It doesn't mean that you're going to be eating well. It doesn't mean that you're going to be going to the doctor when you should. And it doesn't mean that you'll be paying all your bills on time. What it does mean is that you probably won't be malnourished or starved. Now, when you're talking about sort of putting a metric to it, what we're seeing now is that about one in six Americans is below the poverty line. In other words, they can't even begin to pay their bills. Another many tens of millions are hovering just over the poverty line. Now, that doesn't mean they're affluent. What it means is that they're marginally less insecure than the other people. If you take all of the insecurity, the people who are officially poor, the people who are near poor, you're looking at about a third of the American population, just an absolutely enormous well of poverty. And that has all kinds of implications. It has health implications. It has educational implications. It stacks up a whole bunch of problems down the generations. So I think if you're sort of talking about putting a face to the statistics, what it means is it means that there's an awful lot of children going to bed hungry. It means there's an awful lot of adults worrying about homelessness. It means there's an awful lot of schools dealing with children who no longer have a roof over their head. And these are people I've met all around the country. Your project that you said you've been going around the country talking to people is actually very similar to my latest project, which is a book project and an oral history, an audio archive called thevoicesofpoverty.org. And I've been going around the country, I've been to about 25 or 30 states, and everywhere I go, you hear these stories of just utter destitution, and they're very, very similar in many ways to the stories one would have heard during the Great Depression. So I think that's what we mean when we're talking about poverty at this point.
I appreciate that overview. Let me extend this thought. Recently, I pulled into a place to get my car gassed up. I was on the road filming. And when you take it through one of those places that wash the car and then they have the people dry the car, one of the guys just seemed to look different. He was a tall guy, had a crew cut. And so I was just out chatting, and I said, is this your regular job? And he said, no. I said, what's your regular job? He said, well, I'm a little embarrassed to say. I said, well, it's all right. He said, well, I'm an adjunct professor at a college, but I'm not tenured, and I get a relatively small fee, and they've cut back some of my classes. Then I told him what I was doing, and then I showed him some of the actual films and some of the people and their comments, and he agreed to be filmed. Now, you'll see him in the film, but here's what you're going to see, and this is what's invisible. This is not being shown. He showed me the home that he and his wife and child, now a teenager, live in. Very nice, upper-middle-class home in a nice gated community. That's gone. But then, as long as I promised not to show the street or identify the house, he showed me where he lives now. Now he lives in a friend's garage. And what the friend did was he and his friend put a carpet on the floor from their house, and they put in some plumbing and made like a little tiny bathroom, the kind you'd find in an RV, a little shower. And they divided the garage in half with the with their teenage son on a couch, a pull-out couch, and he and his wife in there, and where they came up rather ingeniously by stacking everything from ceiling down. And they wait until, or get up earlier than, their friends so that they don't feel that they're imposing. They don't want the family to impose, because he said, look, do you know what it's like when you listen to a person say they're defending us being here, the wife doesn't like us here, and I can't take us anywhere else? I literally would be in our car with nothing. I have no savings. I've got about $70,000 in debt, and I have nothing. And he said, this is embarrassing. He said, also, this is a home that doesn't allow, it's a single occupants in the home, and they don't allow us to build something like this. So that's why it's done in secret. And he said, but every single house on the street has the same thing. Family members have moved back. They're couch surfing. They fix up attics and basements and garages for people. And he said, now, this is what he said to me. He said, you read about over 6 million homes being foreclosed. I said, well, it's actually closer in the last 8 years to 11 million, and there's 4 people per home, and that's about over 40 million Americans, and yet you don't find them. You think, well, where are these people? And this is where they're at. They have no advocates. There's 18 million hungry children. They are in dire poverty. They have no advocates. You have senior citizens who are not surviving on their Social Security, and now the federal government, the IRS, is deducting upwards of 15% of their Social Security check to repay the colleges for their student loans that they co-signed or signed and were responsible for, even if it's the only source of income they have. And I filmed people who told me that they were making $1,200, now they're making like $800 a month, and that's all they have to live on. It's not enough. And they don't have advocates, yet none of this is being seen. Could you address this? Because I'm finding that the figures the government gives us must be challenged, because they do not represent what I'm seeing out there. And I don't see anyone from the government out there doing the homework I'm doing to show the real degree of the crisis we have. And I'd like, Dean Baker, could you also respond after Sasha? Please continue, okay. Sasha.
Yeah, Gary, I think what you're saying is absolutely right, that there's a tremendous invisibility to poverty. Now, when I was going around the country, you do see it, that you see ex-middle-class families either living in these about-to-be-foreclosed-on large houses, or they've already been foreclosed on. If you're in a place like Las Vegas, let's say, there's just one neighborhood after another of foreclosed houses. If you're in Stockton, California, it's the exact same thing. And as you said, these guys have gone onto couches, they've gone into rental units, they've just generally downsized their lives into ever greater insecurity. The other thing you see, when you were talking earlier about the new poor, the other thing you see is that the old poor has gotten even poorer. I think it's very important in this conversation not to forget the old poor. I was in New Mexico, in southern New Mexico, and I interviewed this couple who had lost their house, and they'd been pretty hard scrabble to begin with. They'd lost their house, and they were now living in a storage container. And it was literally a cinder block storage container on a tiny, scrubby bit of land, had no windows, no ventilation. It was this incubator for germs. For a toilet, they were using a bedpan. And then they were using a propane burner inside this cinder block storage container to cook on. And I just thought, you know, what an extraordinarily, if you like, third world existence. It's so precarious. It's so denuded of dignity. And as I went around the country, I saw that this wasn't an anomaly. There were just so many people I talked to who were living beyond the margins. And one of the things we talked about again and again and again was the loneliness and the invisibility of their condition. Because in America, to socialize, you need money. We socialize in public. We socialize in cafes, in restaurants, in bars. We go to cinemas with our friends. But it takes money to socialize. And one of the things that both the new and the old poor said to me when I talked to them was, look, we've become invisible. We've become nobody. And I thought it's one of the, you know, in a sense, one of the saddest commentaries of where we are as a country at this point, that there are millions of people completely excluded, not just from the cash economy, but from all of the social rituals that go with that. And I think that's one reason that it's so hard to explain this problem to a mass audience, because it really is a problem of invisibility. These people have, in a sense, disappeared. They're formerly Americans, they're formerly still resident, they're formerly still citizens, but they've lost the participatory rights. And I think that's, you know, absolutely tragic what's happening.
Thank you. Dr. Baker.
Yeah, well, I'd carry that stuff further. I think it's important to understand this isn't something that just happened to these people. This is something that was done to them. And I don't mean in a conspiratorial sense that we have some evil people out there who are, you know, rubbing their hands saying how they can make people's lives miserable. But they've rigged the deck. So you were talking earlier about outsourcing. We've lost millions of decent paying jobs in manufacturing through trade policy. It was a deliberate design. It wasn't an accident. They quite deliberately designed trade policy that would put our manufacturing workers in direct competition with the lowest paid workers anywhere in the world, in Mexico, China, wherever it might be. And the predicted result, people sometimes say trade didn't work or the theory didn't work. No, the theory did work. That was exactly the point. What the theory says is when you put a manufacturing worker in the United States who gets paid $20, maybe $25 an hour if they're unionized, you put them in competition with manufacturing workers in China who might get $1 an hour, you lose the job, you know, or you put downward pressure on the wages of those who are able to keep. That's what the theory says. So it's not, you know, when we lost these millions of manufacturing jobs, that wasn't, you know, the thing didn't work, the trade agreements didn't work according to theory. That is what the theory predicts will happen, and that's, of course, what has happened. We've lost millions of decent-paying jobs, and that was a conscious result of trade policy. What happens is you have a lot of policies that people don't understand because they're not talked about, they're not economists, and these have huge, huge importance. I would say much, much more importance, many, many times more importance than what we hear about this or that with the President Bush's tax cuts that, you know, Obama wants to take back on the wealthy, Romney wants to keep. You know, our trade policy dwarfs that, you know, and we don't hear that discussed. One of the big issues here is what happens to the value of the dollar. They run around talking about the strong dollar like we're rooting for a football team. Well, anyone who's rooting for a strong dollar wants to see millions of manufacturing workers unemployed because that's what it means. It means our goods are not competitive because the dollar makes a high-value dollar makes them overvalued. I'll also point out, I don't go in great detail here, but the Federal Reserve Board has enormous importance in terms of determining how many people have work. And one of the things that was done, again, probably almost no one followed it. I'm an economist. This is my job. Ben Bernanke, the current chair of the Federal Reserve Board, said that the Federal Reserve Board is going to have a policy of targeting 2% inflation. And what that means is that if he's concerned that inflation is getting too high, he'll raise interest rates, deliberately throw people out of work to put downward pressure on wages to keep inflation from getting higher. He did this unilaterally, got almost no attention, probably more important than anything Congress is going to do over the next 2 years in terms of people's lives, or 4 years or 6 years or whatever, and almost no one knows about it. So there's a lot of key levers to economic policy have enormous impact that very few people know about because, you know, again, they're not economists, and I'll say the media, the business press, the economic press that's supposed to be reporting on this, they almost never talk about it, and when they do, they usually use language that would be so obscure that even if you're reading it closely, most people would not understand what's at issue.
A follow-up to that, I find it rather hypocritical on the one hand that everyone's in power is rooting for a strong dollar. At the same time, they're criticizing China for having a strong dollar and wanting them to devalue their dollar to make them make opportunities for our exporting goods more likely to happen. That is a contradiction. Also, we're not looking at what role China, Russia, India, South Africa, the BRICS nations have to the future of commerce and the dollar. The idea that our foreign policies, including this childish notion of creating a Pacific and Eurasian base system around China to challenge its China seas trading routes, Russia, the same thing with the missile defense system that was never proven to work in the first place, but we spent hundreds of billions of dollars in that stupid thing. But now you pull back for a moment and you say, well, hold on. Who's giving us all this money? Who's lent us $1,700,000,000,000? China. Japan gave us about $800 billion. Well, what's going to happen to all these cheap products that would be coming into Walmart and other stores in the United States if for some reason China decides that on a political level that it wants to disengage or in some way change nature of the relationship because of our posturing? It's trying to be the world's number one super economic power. They're not bankrupt. Last time I looked, we have over $100 trillion, and not just the $15.3 trillion they're talking about, but in underfunded entitlements and unfunded entitlements and state and federal, corporate and personal debt. You add all that together, it's over $100 trillion. Well, our gross domestic product is $15 trillion. Well, gee whiz, if any other country had the percentage of a debt to gross domestic product, someone would be a little concerned. And then you go agitate, and then you allow possibly, and I you may think this is far afield, but I'd like to see if you believe as I do that there is a connection. If Iran is attacked by Israel and we support them, what do you think China is going to do? Will they continue to support us and give us money, buy our T-bills? Or will they decide with the other nations that maybe it's time then to start going off the dollar as the reserve currency? And if they did do that, which they've indicated they might, what would that do to the value of the dollar? What would that do to the value of what we own, what we could buy? What would happen with inflation at that point? I see these, when I pull back, all these lines and sublines all interconnected. Dr. Baker, would you take a look at this and give us your measured impression, please? And then I'd like Sasha to do the same.
Yeah, I think the whole issue of the debt's been hugely misrepresented, hugely overplayed. If you look at the interest payments that the United States government has on its debt, it's near the lowest level it's been in the whole post-World War II period. It was about 1.5% of GDP this last year. I think it was about 1.3 or 1.4 in 2010. So we actually have very low interest payments on our debt, not high interest payments on the debt. There's a whole industry in Washington funded by Wall Street people that have been trying to hype this stuff for decades. Basically, they want to get rid of Social Security and Medicare. So they've been hyping it to the moon. And the story of China, that's what we're asking them. We want them to stop buying our dollars. We want them to stop buying our T-bills. That's how we get the dollar down so that our goods become competitive. So that's really what we need. So apart, quite the opposite, rather than being a threat, something we have to worry about, it's in fact official policy of both the Obama administration and the Bush administration. This is why I'm pointing out how bad the media's reporting on this is. You have many people saying, oh my God, what if they did that? Well, that's when President Obama's asking them, you know, he sometimes uses the term manipulating the currency. When we're asking them to stop manipulating the currency, what that literally means is we're asking them to stop buying T-bills. That's how they manipulate the currency. That's exactly how they do it. So it's utterly absurd here that on the one hand, we're supposed to be worried that they might do exactly what we've been asking them to do. So if we want our goods to again become competitive in the world economy, we have to have them stop buying up dollars. I fear absolutely zero the idea that they're going to stop buying our T-bills, that the U.S. dollar will stop being the reserve currency, which, again, it's also a confusion because there's not really a single reserve currency. We're the predominant reserve currency, but it's not as though people have to use the dollar, and often they don't. They use euros, they use yen, they use whatever the hell they want. So this whole story, it's really a fictionalized story that has literally no basis in reality.
Okay, well that's one particular opinion. I look at it a little differently. What would you think on this, that both parties, and hence both official economic sets of advisors, both under Bush and under Obama, are beholden to a lot of very strong corporate interests, including Wall Street, including other major industries behind them, and these individuals don't want to see a weakened dollar. They don't want to see us being able to have manufacturing again because they've made their money outsourcing. They made their money by importing cheap products because they own the Walmarts and they own the Kmarts and they own the a lot of the companies that bring us products, and they don't have to pay for union labor anymore. And it's not by myth that 58,000 major factories have disappeared. This isn't because we don't have skilled laborers, people willing to buy something that's made in these factories. It's because they can make this product cheaper. Well, who are these people? These are people that have enormous political clout, and they put a lot of money into these campaigns, and they have a lot of their advisors and think tank experts that they fund, like the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers have over 300 different expert think tanks just in one education, in education alone. They have enormous power of what gets taught in some of the schools around the United States, over 76 different colleges and universities, where they have money that goes in. They get to dictate not only who is hired to teach a course, but what the curriculum should be in that course. So how are you going to have China suddenly becoming less interested and dropping its currency or not buying our currency, and then we start to weaken our currency so we can get back into manufacturing? Exactly who's going to work for the job to manufacture, and who's going to build the plant when Bangladesh is charging 14 cents an hour, China a dollar an hour, Haiti 60 cents an hour? Which company is going to be able to hire people in that range? I just don't see any of these manufacturing jobs coming back to the United States. I don't see the people control the real world economy allowing that. It's just too profitable to have stuff made elsewhere. Your thoughts, please, Mr. Baker.
Well, again, this depends on those countries continuing to buy up our dollar, which, again, your point's exactly right. We have, you know, we have a situation where, on the one hand, you have financial interests that want to be big actors elsewhere in the world. That means they want a high dollar. The other hand, as you said, you have the Walmarts that have set up low-cost supply chains. They'd rather get their stuff for less. They don't want to see the price of everything they get from China go up 20 or 30% if the dollar falls. And, in fact, the manufacturing firms themselves, so the General Electrics, most of the major manufacturing companies, they've outsourced much of their operations, so they're getting low-cost labor. So that's exactly the political issue, that many of the biggest political actors have an interest in continuing to import these goods at very low prices. And what the public has to understand is we really do have an interest in low dollar. And, you know, you're talking about with the low-cost labor, when the dollar falls, that labor goes up in value. And we shouldn't be concerned about that. We want to see those wages rise in dollar terms. It doesn't mean we're getting poor. I mean, the stuff we'll buy at Walmart will cost us more, but the point is we'll have jobs. We'll be able to buy that because we'll have decent-paying jobs. That doesn't make us poor. That makes most of us wealthier. It might make Walmart poorer because their profit margins will be squeezed. But most of us will become wealthier in that because we're going to have decent-paying jobs. There'll be demand for labor.
I appreciate that insight. I do believe that the disparity between what an American worker makes would have to make or historically has made compared to what we're now seeing imported is anywhere between 200 to 300% up to 1,000%. I don't see that gap being closed based upon inflationary factors or weakness or strength of the dollar immediately. Sasha, would you give us your insight, please?
I think you've covered a tremendous amount of ground with the comments in the last few minutes. Let me try and separate out a few of them. The first one was the issue of debt, and it seems to me that there are two kinds of debt. There's the kind of debt that the government accumulates, and within that there's sort of good government debt and bad government debt. And then the second kind is private debt. So when you're talking about government debt, you know, one of the conservative mantras at the moment is that national debt is bad, that we've got to spend down the debt. And they're using the whole idea of a deficit reduction campaign largely as an excuse to change the political language around Social Security, around Medicare, around food stamps, aid to the poor, and so on. And that's a very problematic rhetoric, because government debt used well and wisely can be a powerful economic tool. And as Dean said earlier, we can get money as America as a state can get money at a far lower cost than any other country in the world. That gives us an opportunity to use that money wisely, to invest in jobs, to invest in education, to invest in rebuilding an infrastructure that's been allowed to crumble over 20 or 30 years. That debt isn't necessarily bad. Then you have the unproductive debt. When you give away tax cuts to billionaires and you lose billions or hundreds of billions of dollars of tax revenue each year, and as a result, the national debt gets bigger and bigger, that's bad debt. We're not using it wisely. We're just essentially gifting it to already affluent people. So that's one area. The second area is private debt. And again, anyone who's gone around the country talking to people in poverty or talking to people at risk of poverty will know that private debt is a huge part of that, whether people who borrowed too much to buy houses that were overpriced, people who've had to go into debt to fund healthcare emergencies, people who've gone further and further into debt to try and fund education. And that's a huge problem. And so you do see a tremendous number of people racking up tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt that they'll never be able to pay back. And that's a sort of casino capitalism way of organizing society, and it's clearly unhealthy. There's clearly got to be some kind of change around that. But then the other issue you're talking about is a political issue more than an economic one. You talked about the Koch brothers. You talked about the potential for Middle East destabilization if there was a war between Iran and Israel and so on. And it seems to me that both of those are part of the same issue, which is that as the economy has worsened, what you've seen is the emergence of a series of political crises. You see it in America, you see it in Europe, you see it in the Middle East. You see a destabilized global environment. And whenever there's a destabilized global environment, there's room for chaos, either because new players are trying to take advantage of the weakness of those who are already big players, or because the big players themselves are no longer capable of putting a lid on the chaos. And I think we're seeing that. We're seeing that as America's dominance globally wobbles, that it's creating all kinds of ricochet effects. Now, that's either good or it's bad, depending on one's point of view. But I don't think anyone can deny the fact that the economy and the political systems are intimately linked, and that as you get more and more economic chaos, almost inevitably you get more and more political chaos. It means we're living through interesting times. It doesn't necessarily mean we're living through good times.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Dr. Baker, one of the greatest crises in the United States today is the ghettoization that was virtually overlooked for almost 30 years in the United States in the urban areas. Now that ghettoization is occurring in the suburban areas. And I do not see what is being done. But I do have ideas, and I'd like your ideas, what you believe we could do to de-ghettoize our cities and our suburbs, to bring people there back to a standard of living, or at least to provide some assistance to them so that they're not thrown out of their homes. And so at least they, when the home goes out, you know what happens all over the place, and they're not put out on the street. What would you suggest would be a way of helping people de-ghettoize the United States?
Well, there's a lot of different things you could look to. Again, I do think getting back to full employment should always be really front and center on our agenda. But on top of that, in terms of all these people that are at risk of losing their homes, one of the things that I had been pushing really for 5 years now, I guess it would be the idea that people could stay in their home as renters paying the market rent if they're foreclosed on. It's a very simple solution, doesn't require any government money, any big bureaucracy. It'd simply be part of the foreclosure process, recognizing the extraordinary circumstances we're in, that people would be able to stay, say, 5 years in their home paying market rent, which in many cases people couldn't afford their mortgage, would be able to afford the rent. I think that would go a very long way, fairly simple thing to do. There's so many other things that we really should be talking about in terms of fixing up our cities, our suburban areas, our metro areas. I mean, obviously we do have to do something about global warming, and we've been pretty negligent on that. I mean, the lack of interest in promoting mass transit is just kind of amazing. I mean, I live in D.C., Washington, D.C., and they just keep raising bus fares. And, you know, one of the things I remember early on, some of us were talking about in the stimulus, suppose you made bus transportation free. You know, that'd be a good way to put money in people's pockets and get a lot more people to take public transit. And who knows, maybe they'd like it. Maybe, you know, we can't do that forever, but maybe we could do that for 2 years. And if people liked it, then maybe they would want to pay the taxes for it. Maybe not, but you could see. But that was, you know, just kind of laughed off the table, you know. And then you get this story where they're saying, we don't have enough shovel-ready projects. Well, that's kind of shovel-ready. You just stop collecting stop making people pay money when they get on the bus. That's about as simple as it gets. But for whatever reason, you know, that was the sort of thing that wasn't considered. But, you know, I think that's the kind of thing we should be talking about. One is environmental policy. Two is economic policy, because disproportionately the people who are taking the buses tend not to be the higher income people. But three, you know, in terms of, you know, metro policy, we should in principle want to have more density, not encourage suburban sprawl. And if you made it easier for people to get in and out of the city by mass transit, that's a great way to do that. So, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, I'm just mentioning that. I mean, it's a big question. There's a lot of ways it could go. But, you know, it's kind of a simple thing. And for whatever reason, it was never even, you know, I mean, my particular idea, but nothing like that was ever considered seriously.
I appreciate that. That makes a great deal of sense to give people a chance to pay rent and stay in their home, because we know that the value of a home can go down as much as 18% the moment your neighbor next door is foreclosed on and the home is gutted. And then in come the crimes. No one is talking about the absolute epidemic increase in gangs activity that once were only in inner city, now are everywhere. There's over 257 different major gangs, not just the Mexican Mafia, the 16 Street Group. They're everywhere, and kidnappings are now in the suburbs, in the more affluent areas, is very common. We're not doing anything with this. And social issues, when you become poor, and if you're a person of color and become poor, and as if you're a single woman with a single child and you're poor, which is 44% of all single women with children, then you're in a lot of trouble. Sasha, what do we need to do? First, to help the 18 million hungry children. Secondly, to help the 44% of American children, American women who are single and have a child, since they're at or below the poverty level. And also, at the same time, help address some of the issues of social injustice that increases with your relative level of poverty.
Yeah, I think those are all great questions. And the way I'd look at it is that you can deal with symptoms and you can deal with causes. If you have a certain number of people who are already hungry, you obviously deal with the symptoms. You try and access that. You try and get them to access food stamps, which is one of the best parts of the social safety net still in existence. You expand programs like WIC. You maybe raise the threshold of eligibility for food stamps. There are many nutritional programs that already exist that can be expanded on. You make sure that anyone eligible for free school breakfast and lunches gets them. You make sure that they get them during summer holidays as well through feeding programs. That's addressing a symptom. Then you have this sort of deeper problem. You have how do you tackle the causation? Because ideally, you don't want people falling into deep poverty in the first place. You don't want a country as wealthy as America to have tens of millions of people going hungry. You don't want entire subgroups, whether they're single mothers, whether they're inner city residents, whether they're residents of colonias in the Southwest. You don't want whole demographic subgroups to fall into poverty. So then you have to look at things like education. How do you raise the education levels? How do you bring jobs to deprived areas? How do you protect wages? Do you enact more rigorous minimum wage laws or living wage laws, which actually say, look, if you work 40 hours a week, you are going to earn enough to put food on the table and to pay your rent, as opposed to having to make a choice. Do I pay the rent? Do I buy medicine? Do I put food on the table? Which is what people have to do at the moment. I think you can get into a whole series of conversations about appropriate tax policies, appropriate welfare policies, appropriate safety net and social assistance policies. And the deeper you get into that conversation, the more you're talking about stopping things from happening in the first place. And that sort of segues into the third part. You're talking about the collateral damage caused by poverty, whether it's crime, whether it's rise of these transnational gangs, which is a huge problem where I live in California. And ideally, you want to look at all of these holistically. So instead of thinking, oh, one thing's a criminal justice issue, one thing's an economic issue, one thing's an education issue, etc., you want to find a way to bring all the players to the table and to have these cross-issue conversations. And people like Kamala Harris, the Attorney General in California, have done a really good job about bringing different players to the table. But I think, to be absolutely honest, none of this is going to work unless we have more of a sense of political participation and ownership over our own politics. And this comes back to something you were saying earlier in the show. When you've got groups like the Koch brothers, individuals like the Koch brothers, or Sheldon Adelson, or Foster Freese, or any of these other individuals who are pumping tens of millions of dollars essentially into buying the political system lock, stock, and barrel, when you have a situation like that, it's incredibly disempowering to the 99%, the people who don't have money, who don't have access, who don't have influence. And as long as that situation persists, you're going to end up with a politics skewed toward the wealthy. So you're going to end up with a politics that doesn't pay attention to the social issues, that doesn't invest in the safety net, that doesn't really invest in education systems. And I think that's one of the great challenges, and it's sort of a chicken and egg challenge. Until the political system is made more accountable, the economy won't improve. But until the economy improves and you have more people feeling empowered, the political system is going to remain skewed toward the rich.
Okay.
If I can jump in on that,
sure, given
that it's Labor Day, I think it's really worth mentioning here that a big part of that story is the collapse of unions in the United States over the last three decades.
Absolutely.
If you go back to 1980, roughly 20% of the private sector workforce was unionized. Today it's about 7%. And that's not an accident. I mean, this is deliberate policy. You had Republicans in particular, but it wasn't just the Republicans, but it was certainly led by President Reagan, and many Democrats, of course, did jump in, designing quite deliberate anti-union policies with the idea that they were going to break the unions that were there, make it much harder to organize. And as a result of that, we've seen, you know, unionization rates here literally plummet, you know. So that makes a huge difference both directly in the sense that workers are much less well situated to bargain for a decent wage, but also indirectly because exactly as Sasha was saying, you know, you have the Koch brothers, you have these very wealthy people out there who could look to buy elections, buy newspapers, buy think tanks. The unions traditionally have been a major force, the major force on the other side, and they're still there, but they're much less important when they're 10% of the workforce back than three decades ago when they were over 20%.
Final question, Dr. Baker. The issue of vulture and shock capitalism, how corporate America benefits financially from increasing poverty and lowering standards of living and wages, they make money off that as well.
Well, you know, from the standpoint, you know, we get sort of a symbol here with Mitt Romney because that's, you know, that's in effect what, you know, and I won't speak specifically about Bain Capital because I don't know exactly what Bain Capital has done, but that is the private equity model. It's, you know, you take over a company, you go, where can we cut costs? And much of those costs are going to be workers' wages. So, you know, again, I mean, I'm not saying they're trying to impoverish people, but they're going, these are a cost. We have workers that have been with the company 15, 20, 25 years. They've built up seniority, they have a pension coming to them, they have benefits, you know, healthcare benefits, and they go, hey, we could hire someone at the minimum wage, or better yet, you know, outsource to another country if it's a manufacturing operation. And that's what they're doing. And, you know, they stand to make lots of money that way. It's often a very short-term strategy, but that's all they're thinking, because if they could, you know, take a company that's, say, marginally profitable, juice up its profits through, you know, laying off workers, downsizing in various ways, taking advantage of tax schemes, and then sell it for two, three, four times the price. Well, because it's a heavily leveraged deal, that's how you get very rich. And, of course, that's exactly what Mitt Romney's done. He's obviously a very wealthy man. So, you know, Bain has used tactics like that. And, again, I can't speak that much to their specific cases, but certainly private equity, there are many cases that is what they are about.
Sasha, a quick answer to finish off our program today. Why is it that the mainstream media has refused to look at the Dr. Jill Stein and the Green Party or Gary Johnson or Rocky Anderson or the others from third parties that have some very legitimate economic platforms that could actually make a difference in our poverty level going forward?
No, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, the easy answer would be, oh, it's a sort of conspiracy of elite media owners and so on and so forth. And I actually don't think that's the case. I think that most political journalists are very conscientious. They want to cover the news, but they believe, rightly or wrongly, that the system itself is so rigged. And I don't mean conspiratorially rigged. What I mean is that it's designed in a way that produces only two parties with a chance of winning. And they sort of believe that both parties are large enough coalitions that you can create broad debates within the parties, and therefore there's no need for third parties, fourth parties, and fifth parties. The problem with that analysis is that increasingly both major parties essentially share the same view. They fight on the margins, and some of those fights are very bitter and very public. But for many years now, there's been a broad consensus that generally government's inefficient, generally taxes are at very best a necessary evil, generally the discussion should be about the middle classes, not the working classes and the poor. And I think you end up with a sort of self-limiting situation where both parties tend to share at least as much as they disagree on. There's far more consensus in our politics than one would actually think.
We appreciate. We're out of time. Sasha Abramsky, Dr. Dean Baker, thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it. I'm Gary Noll. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, Rising Epidemic of Poverty in America and How Corporations and Banks Increase It for Profit and Power. Have a nice day.